talking about? It's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Amy Adams.
Hi, Amy. How you going?
Hi, Laura. Good. How you going?
I'm pretty good. Well, where in New Zealand are you today?
Today, I'm in Dunedin, actually, and it's lovely day. Beautiful day.
Oh, I love hearing like whereabouts in the country you are. It sounds like such an interesting life.
We're lucky New Zealand's kind of small. You know, at least we can get around pretty much everywhere in a day, so I'm very lucky getting to see all different parts.
Yeah, just like an hour-long plane ride to get wherever you need to go. That's good.
Right.
So with travel in mind, let's jump into the tourist levy.
Sure.
So
yeah, look, it's interesting, isn't it? So we're going to have this new $35 tax at the border. But, you know, interesting, Australians don't pay. They're our biggest single market of tourists. And actually what they're going to do is set up this system. If anyone's been to States recently, they'll know the ESTA system, where you've got to go online and basically apply to come here, which creates a whole lot of cost just in that process alone. And then, at the end of it, there'll be a bit of money. They're estimating about $80 million. And then that's split between tourism and conservation. So in terms of funding tourism infrastructure, it's not going to get anywhere near addressing the issues, but it does have a real risk of putting off visitors to come to New Zealand. And of course, so many people rely on tourism for their jobs. If it has a detrimental effect, that could massively outweigh the very little bit of money that'll be raised to fund infrastructure.
But I mean, we also have to take it back to, this is $35. Anyone who's traveling, a tourist coming, like usually a holiday is not a time where you're like, I need to scrimp on my savings. $35 doesn't seem like enough to put someone off.
Yeah, but it's on top of obviously what is already an expensive destination. Traveling with a family of four, it's amazing how quickly the costs do rack up, and it becomes an expensive place. You don't tend to come to New Zealand because Australia is excluded, so people coming here are coming a long way. You don't tend to come just for a couple of days. If you come into New Zealand, you're coming for a while, and that gets expensive. So you just don't know at what point it's going to make a difference. But my concern is, we do have to think a bit differently, I think, about how we pay for tourism infrastructure, because we have got behind in lots of ways across New Zealand, and this just isn't going to be a mechanism that makes anywhere near enough money to do it.
I do kind of have to question National a bit, because every single week it is a new thing about critiquing a new tax policy. But the critique, I sometimes find that the critique doesn't really have a solid basis. In this case, just personally, I don't see that a critique really has a solid basis.
Well, why do you say that? So are you saying that we shouldn't hold the government to account?
No, absolutely. That is 100% what opposition is meant to do and what journalists ourselves are meant to do. But every single week, it does seem like just repetitive and holding government to account purely for the sake of holding them to account.
No, not at all, actually. When government comes out with stuff that we think is sensible, we're quite happy to work constructively with them, and we do that. But, that doesn't tend to make the news in the same way. So, a great example at the moment, we're working really closely with the government on the climate change reforms and setting up a climate change commission. We want to do that hand in hand with them. There's a number of things that are going on in my own portfolio where I think there's some good stuff happening. So while we disagree with the government on a bunch of new taxes, I think taking the time to look at the tax system through the working group is a good thing, and I've made that case publicly a couple of times. Equally, there's a review going on of the Reserve Bank Act and how that's set up, and again, I've come out and said, look, I think it's useful to review some of these things, and I think there are improvements that are being made that a bunch of them we support. So there's a lot we do support. It doesn't get as much air coverage, but we are really concerned that there are all these new taxes coming in, and cost of living is going up. There's no doubt. I mean, we're seeing the price of petrol at record highs. We're seeing rents at record highs. We know that the cost of food, often linked to those two things, is going up. And now we've had a report out saying that electricity and gas prices are likely to go up because of government policy. And we think we do need to highlight the way that government policy is putting more and more costs on New Zealanders. Now, with the tourist tax, it's not New Zealanders. But as I said, if it gets to a point where it affects the tourism sector, then that would be a concern.
There's also the parallel there with not wanting to tax New Zealand citizens, but debt collection seems to happen more often when it comes to National being in government. Last time in 2016, the debt percentage under GDP was 24.6%, whereas under Labour in 2008 was 5.5%. What do you have to say about that kind of parallel?
So you're talking about the amount of Crown debt?
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say is very simple, really. When National took office in 2008, New Zealand economy was already in recession, and the books actually were forecast to be in deficit for the next 10 years, which is as far forward as they look. So the economy had already got into a position where we were spending more than we earned year after year after year, which is going to add to the debt. Then, of course, the global financial crisis happened. Now, I'm not obviously blaming that on the previous government, but it was something that happened worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And then following that, we had the Canterbury earthquakes and then the Kaikoura earthquakes, which had huge impact. And we made a decision as government that that's exactly why you want debt headroom, because when those things happen, that's when you need to borrow money to support the population. So I don't think you can compare times of economic boom and what happens to debt then, where debt has to be coming down, versus those times of real economic challenge. And no one would question that during those years of the GFC and the earthquakes, we had some remarkable costs on our economy. So of course debt went up. But actually, National has a far better track record at bringing debt down through economic good times. Our concern is when debt is going up through economic good times, that's the opposite of what should happen.
Mm. I'm going to jump onto the Walker jumping bill.
Yeah.
Paralleling those jumping words there. So you were obviously involved in the debate on Wednesday, I believe it was, correct?
Yeah. I don't think I gave a speech on Wednesday, but I have been involved in the bill as it's passed through the House.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the bill?
Look, you're criticising me again for being critical, but I do think this bill is a real concern for democracy. And it's not just National saying this. Actually, the International Parliamentary Union has done a report worldwide on the use of these sorts of provisions in law. And they come out pretty strongly and say they're anti-democratic, they're bad for democracy, they go against human rights, and actually they list the countries that have these sorts of provisions, and they're countries like Zimbabwe and Congo and Sierra Leone, and sort of countries we wouldn't want to hold ourselves up against. So it's not just us saying that we think these are poor anti-democratic practices. This is decried by the body that is a sort of the international example of best practice. When communities vote for their local MP, my view is that MPs should be responsible first and foremost to those communities. And my concern is, with this bill, it effectively makes MPs far more beholden to their parties than to their communities. And I worry that that's going to create more of a disconnect between our parliamentarians and our parliamentarians and the communities that put them there.
Yeah, I do also think about it in terms of, so obviously this bill gives the leader the potential to oust one of the members of parliament. When it comes to the structure of our political system, the voter base votes it in. So it's kind of like you have that structure being reshuffled when you have that happening. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, but equally we've got a rule that when there's a by-election, that distorts the proportionality of Parliament. Mm-hmm. So when National lost the Northland seat in a by-election when we were in government, the proportionality of Parliament got changed. Now, this bill doesn't seek to address that. So it's not about maintaining the proportionality at all costs. It is simply if the party leader decides that one of their members is not acting as they would want them to, they can effectively have them removed. Now, they've always been able to throw them out of their caucus, and that's fair enough. We're a membership organisation, and if you don't go along with what the agreements of your organisation are, then you can be removed from that. But to kick them out of Parliament is quite a different step. And as I say, my concern is that when people vote and so on in my seat, they decide which party they want to vote for, and then they decide who they want to be their local representatives.
Mm.
And it should only be the voters who have the right to remove that local representative.
Yeah, I do kind of, this is something that I've thought about quite consistently when it came to National over this year, harping back to abortion being the Crimes Act and how Bridges' speeches around it weren't, they weren't exactly pro-choice, but then you had yourself and Nikki Kaye who were pro-choice, and that was a differentiation in your party, which was interesting to see. It's not something I commonly see But with this bill being in place, would that mean that disagreements like that couldn't happen as often?
Yeah, it can mean that. I mean, abortion's a conscience issue in our party, so we're all free to vote as we choose. But let me give you another example. So in my first term in Parliament, a good friend of mine, actually, Nikki Kaye, came out and said she was really concerned about our own policy on mining as it had pertained to Great Barrier Island. She was the MP for Great Barrier Island, and she said, look, she didn't support any mining on Great Barrier Island because that's what her community wanted. Now, that was against what our party position was, and Nikki, quite rightly, stood up for her community and actually got a change to our policy. My concern is that with a bill like this, Nikki, for her to make a statement like that, she risked getting booted out. Now, I think, as the local MP for Auckland Central, she did absolutely the right thing, saying, actually, this isn't good for my community and I'm going to argue against it. With this bill in place, she would have been effectively muzzled because she knew that if she'd spoken out, she could have been booted out of Parliament. And as I say, she was doing the right thing, backing her community, and as a result, actually forced a change to our position. But with a bill like that, I really worry that people won't have that sort of courageous stance.
Wow, that is quite unfortunate. I'll try and keep my opinion out of that one. So also, and something that's happened this week is Mika Waititi, the debate around her. What you were involved in that one, correct?
Yeah. I moved a debate motion for that,
So what happened there? What were your thoughts?
Well, every time a minister is sacked from their ministerial warrants, it's a big deal. I mean, ministers have a hugely important role in our system, and they hold a position of high trust. And when ministers have their warrants removed, I think there's an expectation across Parliament, but actually more importantly out in the public, that there's a right to know what's gone on. And so the public can judge for themselves whether it's been handled appropriately, and they can judge for themselves whether the person can be brought back as a minister at some point, or whether they should remain as an MP. And our concern was that there was a lack of transparency as to exactly what had gone on. And there was very little information provided. And while we were told that a report would be available at some point in the future, we were also told that that would be a redacted version of the report. So our concern was that there was actually an expectation on the government to be clear about what had happened, and then the public can judge, as I say, whether it was handled appropriately. And that information and that transparency simply wasn't there.
What do you... Obviously, you think that government should be transparent about this issue. What do you think should be done about Mika Waititi?
Well, the interesting thing is when... So there's been a number of examples where National have had MPs who've acted in a way that the public thought was inappropriate, and they have been hounded out of Parliament. So we've got a situation here where we now know that Ms. Waititi laid hands on her staff member, and the report has apparently found that to the extent that bruising was left. So we're not talking about a simple touch. We're talking about something that does certainly sound like, in legal terms, what would be classed as an assault. Now, that's, I think, pretty unacceptable. I think any form of workplace bullying or certainly an assault of a staff member is extremely serious, certainly calls into question her ability to be a minister, but I think also calls into question her ability to serve properly as an MP. When I think back to one of our MPs, Todd Barclay, who was accused of recording a staff member in a conversation where the staff member didn't know they were being recorded. He wasn't a minister, but he was effectively hounded out of Parliament because the other side of the House, the people who are now in government, insisted that that made him unfit to be an MP. Well, if that's the case, then the same standards should be applied here.
I mean, it is still... It hasn't... it's not conclusive that she did this. It's still an alleged assault, correct?
Well, none of us have seen the report, and that's part of the challenge because the Prime Minister hasn't released it. But what we know from the details that have emerged is that the person who did the inquiry has apparently found that the staff member's view of the situation is the more believable. Now, I'm being cautious because I haven't seen the report. We only know what's been written in the papers. But that you know, if that's what this person has found, our system relies on a case of deciding what is a more likely version of events, and that is what this person has found is a more likely version of events. Now, that being the case, I guess that's what the public needs to form their views on.
Oh yeah, it does also come down to innocent until proven guilty. Like, surely it's more believable according to, well, more believable, but it's not definitive yet. So in the way of not bringing the hammer down, in a sense, you are giving time and space for that to really be made clear, correct?
Well, if you followed that line of thinking, you'd effectively be saying that no action can be taken unless the person admits it. And mm-hmm. that certainly wasn't the standard that was applied for Todd Barclay. He certainly didn't agree with the allegations that were levelled against him. But as I say, the very people who are now saying, well, we can't do anything because Ms. Fytherie doesn't accept that, are the ones who hounded Todd out of Parliament.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, that is all the time we have, but thank you so much for talking with me, Amy Adams. You are such a good sport.
Okay, see
you. You have a good one. Bye.
You too. Bye.
The National Party's Amy Adams on 95 BFM.
The Wire.